You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha. This is Lecture 4, entitled Regarding the Physical and the Moral. The more we study the mystery of Golgotha in accordance with spiritual science, the more we realize that future ages will have to penetrate ever more and more deeply into this mystery. People will come to see that what they have hitherto understood of it is but a preparation for what they will have to understand and live regarding it in the future. It is no doubt true that what we are acquiring through spiritual science in a somewhat complicated way today, and one that many people call, quote, difficult of comprehension, close quote, will one day be made known to us in a few words. It is easy to see how this must be. The course of spiritual life is such that great and simple truths that can be put in a few words have first to be worked for, striven for, that not in every age can the profound truths be put in simple forms. We must accept it as the karma of our age, that we have still to labor before our souls can grasp the full weight and importance of the mystery of Golgotha. I will begin today with the aphoristic teaching so necessary to the understanding of, in quotes, faith and, in quotes, belief as force-bearing qualities. We have to realize that the materialistic outlook is in the course of excluding all moral considerations from its view of the world. Many people today only regard the physical and chemical laws in accordance with which the earth came into existence from out a world mist at the beginning, and they strive to grasp how these laws must necessarily continue, so that the earth may in some way be brought to an end. Side by side with these physical conceptions, we have acquired moral conceptions. But I have already pointed out that these have not sufficient strength to achieve reality. That they may acquire this strength is our task at the present day. And as we progress in the development of such ideas, they will have to be carried ever further and further. To those who hold by the tenets of natural science, it may seem somewhat fantastic, somewhat superstitious, to believe that an event stands at the very beginning of our earthly existence which has to be judged by moral laws, as is the case in the Bible story of the fall. Our imagination at the present day is not sufficiently powerful to enable us to conceive of an evolution in morality, nor are we able, by its help, to place a moral event at the end of earthly existence, by which event everything of a physical nature would undergo such a moral evolution that the earth would thereby be exalted to another planetary condition. Conceptions regarding what is moral and what is physical exist side by side, but not simultaneously. Natural science strives to eliminate morality altogether from its way of regarding things, and morality revenges itself for this by withholding from the content of its ideas the force necessary to deal with physical things. The dogmatism of certain religious beliefs forms ideas that are a sort of compromise with natural science, so that the scientist notices a sharp line is drawn between what is moral and what is physical, chemical, geological, and so on. I shall begin my lecture today with something that apparently has no connection with our subject. It does, however, lead directly to it. First, let me say that not all those who devote themselves to the study of the universe are so built that they exclude all moral considerations from their study of external nature and the activities of nature. No modern botanist would apply moral ideas to his study of the growth of plants. He would consider it childish to apply a moral standard to the vegetable kingdom or to inquire into plant morality. People did not, however, always think thus. I will give you a characteristic example of a man who did not, a man who was held by many not to be a good Christian, but who, in his observations of the world, was a better Christian than many. In certain writings about Goethe, especially those by Catholic writers, you find it stated that he bore himself with complacency toward religion, that he did not take religion seriously. There was in Goethe's whole disposition, however, a profound Christian tendency, something far more profoundly Christian than is to be found in those who, according to the familiar phrase, have "Lord, Lord" ever on their lips. Goethe had not this cry always on his lips, but his way of regarding the world was profoundly Christian in character, and I would like to draw your attention to something in him that is not often remarked. In his book about metamorphosis, Goethe endeavors to make his ideas on the growth of plants known. I have frequently had occasion to refer to a conversation that Goethe once held with Schiller, after they had both listened to a lecture by Professor Bartsch. Schiller did not much like the way in which the professor spoke of plants on that occasion, and said it was not necessary to tear everything so much to pieces, that it was possible to hold quite other opinions on the subject. Goethe then sketched, in a few words, his idea of the metamorphosis of plants, and showed what might be considered as the spiritual link binding the various plant formations to one another. In reply, Schiller said, quote, "That is not outward reality. It is but an idea." Close quote. Goethe did not quite understand this, and said, quote, "If that is only an idea, then I see ideas with my eyes." Close quote. He could not understand how an idea could signify anything unless it were derived from reality, in the same way that tone and color are derived from reality. Goethe maintained that he saw his ideas, which proves that he strove to see something spiritual in the growth of plants. Now, Goethe realized that he could not fully communicate his ideas to his contemporaries, for the time was not yet ripe to receive them. Meanwhile, other naturalists, among them the botanists Schelver and Henschel, had been stimulated by Goethe's theory of metamorphosis. They wrote the most remarkable things about plant growth which met with Goethe's approbation. But the modern botanist regards this whole subject, as dealt with by Goethe, Schelver, and Henschel, as midsummer madness. In cases such as this, we must adapt the words of Paul and say, quote, "What is foolishness to man may be wisdom in the sight of God." Close quote. And Goethe then jotted down his impressions of Schelver's method of presentation. I will now outline briefly what Schelver wished to establish. The existing approach to botanical studies was anathema to him. At this time, the generally accepted view was that plants are divided into plants with female flowers and plants with male flowers, that the ovule is fertilized by the pollen from the stamens, and so a new individual arises. Schelver firmly rejected this view, since it did not accord with the nature of the plant kingdom. The fact is, he said, that every plant, by virtue of its nature, can reproduce its kind. He looked upon fertilization as a more or less secondary phenomenon, as a mistake, an aberration of nature. If nature followed the right course, Schelver believed, then each plant would reproduce its kind without fertilization. There would be no need for pollination in order to ensure the continuity of the plant species. Goethe, who had made a close study of such phenomena as the metamorphosis of the leaf into the flower, regarded it as self-evident that the whole plant would reproduce its kind through metamorphosis. He was attracted by Schober's idea, and in all seriousness he recorded his reflections on the subject in a series of aphorisms which are extremely interesting, but which modern botanists regard as pure nonsense. In his article on Schober, he wrote, amongst other things, quote, "This new theory of pollination would doubtless be most welcome and most seemly when lecturing to young people and ladies, for, with the existing theories, the teacher finds himself in considerable embarrassment. Moreover, whenever innocent young minds, desirous of perfecting their knowledge, consulted botanical textbooks, they could not conceal the fact that their moral feelings were outraged. These perpetual nuptials, which reduce monogamy, on which morals, law, and religion are founded, into a vague and undefined lasciviousness, are wholly intolerable to the pure in heart." Close quote. Thus Goethe, surveying the plant kingdom, finds it intolerable that there is no escape from these perpetual nuptials. He finds it, as he so delicately puts it, more seemly not to have to mention them. It is far better, in his view, to teach the asexual reproduction of plants. He then elaborated further on this and wrote, quote, "People have often reproached scholars, and not without justification, for having shown undue interest in the slightly improper and frivolous passages of ancient authors, in order to compensate, to some extent, for the tedium and aridity of their own writings. In the same way, certain naturalists, seeing Mother Nature partly in the buff, went so far as to crack ribald jokes at her expense, as they never failed to do about old Baubo. We recall having seen arabesques which depicted most realistically, in the style of antique art, the sexual relationships within the calyx." Close quote. Goethe therefore thought it highly desirable that the study of sexual behavior in the plant kingdom should be abolished. But of course, this was considered to be an absurd idea, even in Goethe's time. And today, in the age of psychoanalysis, which seeks a sexual explanation for everything, it would seem more foolish still to say that it would be a good thing if we could dispense with the immoral notion of sexuality in our study of nature. Goethe expressly says, quote, "Just as we find everywhere today ultras, liberal as well as royalist, so Schober was an ultra on the question of metamorphosis. He broke through the narrow limitations of the earlier theory." Close quote. Goethe does not say that he found an ultra such as Schober in any way antipathetic. On the contrary, he warmly welcomed his appearance. We shall the better understand what lies behind all this if we enter more deeply into the soul of Goethe, I mean into his Christian soul. Those who study nature as it is from the standpoint of modern science can of course make nothing of such ideas, for certain assumptions are necessary before these ideas can be understood. It must first be assumed that the plants, as they are at present, belie their original design. Those who make a detailed study of the plant kingdom are compelled to acknowledge that when they reflect upon the original design of plant growth, they find that fertilization by wind-blown pollen does not accord with the original intention of nature. Fertilization should take a different form. The only course open to us, therefore, is to recognize that the whole flora around us shows a deterioration from its original form, and that a view of nature, such as that of Goethe, still discovered in the form of plants, as they are today, an intimation of what they had been before the fall. Indeed, we cannot understand Goethe's theory of metamorphosis unless we appreciate its childlike innocence, unless we realize that Goethe wished to indicate by this theory that the present mode of reproduction in the plant kingdom is not what was originally intended. It arose only after the earth had fallen from a higher sphere to its present level. There is no other course open to us, therefore, than to realize that the entire vegetable kingdom as it lies spread before our eyes, has degenerated from its original form to the present one, and that Goethe's view of nature contained an inkling of what this condition was before the fall, to use a symbolic expression. It is not possible to understand Goethe's teaching on the metamorphosis of plants unless we can grasp the thought of the innocence, the childlikeness which he sought to express when he said, quote, "Look what takes place in the vegetable kingdom. This is not what was originally ordained. Present conditions only arose after earthly evolution had fallen from a certain sphere to that in which it now is." Close quote. Starting from this point, your imagination will soon show you that it is the same with regard to the mineral kingdom. It also is not what it was originally. I cannot go into this more fully at the moment, but it will be referred to later. Those of you who are able to study such subjects in a thoroughly scientific way will realize that what I have said is correct as far as to the animal kingdom. The cold-blooded animals, that is, it does not apply to those with warm blood. The mineral kingdom, the plant kingdom, and the kingdom of cold-blooded animals, those having no inner warmth, these three are not such as it was originally intended they should be. They have descended from one sphere to another. Here, they first developed qualities which necessitated the entry of the principle of sex which governs them at the present time. These three kingdoms are unable, therefore, to develop entirely in accordance with their original predispositions. They must have help before they can do this. Originally, plants had fitting attributes by which they could not only bring about the metamorphosis of leaf into blossom, but could also produce an entirely new plant. Now they have no longer the power to do this. They require a new stimulus from without, because plants have forsaken the realm in which they dwelt originally. In the mineral kingdom, things were also meant to have been different than they are now, and also in the kingdom of the cold-blooded animals, which creatures are ordained to remain at a halfway stage, as it were. Let us now turn to the other end of nature, to the warm-blooded animals, the physical human kingdom, and to the kingdom of those plants which attain to the formation of wood, that is, trees. The plants, previously mentioned, are those that follow the regular metamorphosis, producing blossoms from leaves and are not wood-forming. I stated in a former lecture that physical man, as he is at present, is not in accordance with the original plan laid down for him. Originally, his physical body was intended for immortality. Knowledge goes still further. It is not only physical man who has failed to carry to completion the attributes that were his originally, but other creatures also have assumed the tendency toward death. These are wood-forming plants and the warm-blooded animals. These are not as originally created, not that they were created immortal, but they have deteriorated, and therefore other conditions have arisen in them. Mineral creation, part of the vegetable creation, and cold-blooded animals are unable to carry to completion the predispositions that were inherent in them. For this, they have need of an influence to come to their aid from without. The warm-blooded creatures of the animal kingdom, on the other hand, wood-forming trees and man, are unable, as at present constituted, to show forth their origin. If we accept this statement, it is easy to see the direction that the study of nature will take in the future. We must clearly and once and for all distinguish between what the creature now is and what it was intended it should be. The question now arises, from what cause has this deterioration come to pass? All nature, as we see it around us, and as it is seen when scientifically investigated, is not such as it was intended it should be. How has this come about? The answer is, man is guilty of it all, and man's guilt consists in his having succumbed to the temptation of Lucifer, that event so often referred to by me, and which is described at the beginning of the Bible as the fall, or as original sin, in quotes. To spiritual science, this is a real, a very actual fact, but one that does not affect man alone. It was certainly brought about by man, but man at that time was so mighty, he had such power, that he involved, along with himself, all the rest of creation. He involved, along with himself, the plant creation, so that these were unable to complete their evolution, but required a stimulus from without. He was the cause that alongside of the cold-blooded animals, warm-blooded ones came into existence, that is, animals capable of suffering pain as he does. Through man, therefore, these warm-blooded animals have become involved in the sphere to which he has himself been drawn because of his having succumbed to the temptations of Lucifer. People imagine that man's relationship to the world has always been the same as it is today, that he is in no way concerned with external nature, that the animals and plants around him have come into existence without having been influenced by him. This has not always been so. Before the present order of nature arose, man was a mighty being, who not only participated in that event which is called the Luciferian temptation, but involved in it, along with himself, all the rest of creation. This event was the cause, and had its culmination in the result, that the moral law has been entirely divorced from the law of nature. Anyone saying such things, as I have said today, is naturally not understood in the least by those who think along the lines of natural science. Yet such things must be understood. They must be understood. Modern science is but an episode. In spite of all its gains, in spite of its great achievements, it is but an episode. It will be replaced by another science, which will recognize once more that there's a higher way in which to regard the universe. In this new science, nature and morality will form two sides of one whole. Such a science will never be reached through a vague pantheism. It will teach men to recognize in an entirely concrete way what is indeed revealed by external nature, that originally it was designed for something other than what is disclosed in the general order of nature today. Men must have the courage to estimate external nature by the measure of morality. This method of looking at the world, which is called monistic, and which glories in the exclusion of all that is moral, does so with timidity, from cowardice of the understanding that has not the courage to push on far enough, and so falls short of the point where the absolute necessity arises of applying the moral standard, just as the scientific standard must be applied in the study of external nature. Goethe had this courage, the possibility of thinking of the world as once again permeated with morality would have been utterly lost if, at the beginning of our era, the mystery of Golgotha had not supervened. We have just seen that what may be called the purely natural law had, in a certain sense, become corrupt. It had degenerated and sank from a higher sphere to the present one, from which, according to our view, it is necessary that it should rise once more. Our views with regard to the whole universe belong indeed to the same category. Their standpoint is one from which they must mount upward once more. If Dubois-Raymond and others confess that our thoughts at the present day are incapable of attaining to reality, that they have remained at the stage of ignorabimus, this is to some extent true. And why? Because thought has also forsaken its predestined realm, and will have to find its way back. Everything is affected by this deterioration of thought. and those who say that thought has no longer the force necessary to the attainment of reality are, to some extent, right. Thought, along with all the rest of creation, has deteriorated, and it must rise once more. The impulse through which thought can be reinstated is to be found in the mystery of Golgotha. It is to be found in that power which, like a mighty impulse, entered earthly evolution at that time. Even our thought has participated in the fall, and must be redeemed before it can partake once more of reality. The natural science of today, with its necessarily non-moral outlook, is the outcome of this decline in thought. If we have not the courage to recognize this, we are standing without, not within, reality. That spiritual content whereby something from a higher sphere descended to a lower, in order that it might restore what was there, emerges with special clarity when certain concrete facts are kept in view, and when we ask ourselves the question, quote, what would have become of earthly evolution after its deterioration through the action of man, if it had not received a new impulse through the mystery of Golgotha? Close quote. Just as a plant cannot bring forth new life if its seed vessels are torn from it, so the earth would not have been able to carry out its further development had it not been for the mystery of Golgotha. We are entering at the present time the fifth post-Atlantean age. The mystery of Golgotha took place during the first third of the previous age, the fourth. Everywhere we see evidences of a descent in evolution. Thought, capable of penetrating to the essential nature of things, has indeed suffered a terrible decline. Hardly any trace of an upward tendency in thought as regards the real nature of things can be marked. The Copernican theory of the universe and like discoveries are certainly magnificent as regards surface knowledge. They do not penetrate to the depths, but only appear to do so, because for long people have ceased to search these depths. The failure of thought to attain to reality will become more and more marked, and we can point out some concrete instances, however fantastic these may seem, of what would happen if the present trend of thought were to go on smoothly and unaltered in the same direction. But this direction will have to be altered, because the impulse of the mystery of Golgotha will make itself ever more and more felt. I ask you to look with me for a moment through a window, as it were, into the possibilities of future evolution, and do not laugh too loudly at the facts, yes, the facts I am about to describe. If the opinions that prevail in the schools of natural science at the present day were carried to their logical conclusion and grew ever more and more intense, most strange things would have resulted if the mystery of Golgotha had not brought about a more profound way of regarding things. We are now living in the fifth post-Atlantean period and are just entering on the sixth, which will be followed by the seventh. If I were to speak publicly today about a new way of regarding the fall, as can be done in a circle such as this, which for years has been accustomed to the ideas held within our movement, and if I were to say that this could be demonstrated scientifically, people in the material world would consider me a fool and laugh me to scorn. In the sixth post-Atlantean period, things will be very different, as indeed they are different among some people today. The struggle will be bitter before the Christ impulse can be brought through. People think that those who strive to arrive at the truth by means of spiritual science can be fought with the weapons of scorn and mockery, some call it criticism, and in the sixth period they will begin to treat such individuals medically. They will try to cure them medically. Medicines will, by that time, have been discovered, which will be administered compulsorily to those who hold that there is an established standard of good and evil, that good and evil are something more than mere human institutions. A time will come when people will say, quote, "What is all this talk about good and evil? Good and evil are regulated by the state. What the laws declare to be good, what the laws declare to be good is good. What they declare to be evil is evil. When you speak of good and evil as something moral, you must be ill." Close quote. Medicine will then be administered to these people in order to cure them. This is whither our age is tending. It is no exaggeration. I have but opened a window through which you can look. The march of time is toward such things. At what would follow in the seventh period, I will not let you look. This window I will not open. All the same, what I have said is true. Human nature cannot be suppressed, and it will gradually express itself in ways like these. The simplest investigations into truth reveal what I have just told you, and those who have eyes to see and ears to hear with can perceive on every side the beginnings of these things. The human etheric is not such as it was originally designed to be. It concerns us most seriously to recognize this fact and make it a part of our life, for it concerns us most vitally. Everything that has since come to pass is because of this difference. Among the many etheric substances our etheric bodies originally contained, in all their living fullness, is the warmth which it still possesses. This it shares with the warm-blooded animals, whom man has brought down with him in his fall. Man is able to make use of this warmth ether in a special way. This he cannot do with the light ether. He certainly is able to receive it, but it only streams from him again, so that, to a low form of clairvoyance, it can be perceived in the etheric colors of the human aura. It is, however, present in him. Besides this, man was organized with a specific tone within the whole sphere harmony. He was endowed with a specific tone and with an original life, so that it was always possible for the ether body, if it had retained its original vital force, to have preserved the immortality of the physical body. In this case, many things would have been different. For had the ether body retained its original construction, man would have continued to dwell in those higher realms from which he has now fallen. He would not have succumbed to the temptation of Lucifer, for in those higher realms conditions were very different, and souls like St. Martin still retained some consciousness of what these conditions had been, and were able to speak of them as of one-time realities. Let us endeavor to call up before our souls what some of these conditions were. Man could not have spoken at that time as he does today, for speech had not as yet been differentiated into languages, which differentiation came about because speech had become somewhat fixed. It was not intended that this should happen. Language was ordained to be something quite different than it is, and it is well to try and picture vividly what was originally intended for man. Picture to yourselves that man still had the predispositions that were originally his. At that time, when he looked at any object, and it made an impression on him, it was not merely colors, not merely sounds that approached him, but along with these impressions, spirit flowed toward him on every hand. As well as the color red, the spirit of red approached him when he beheld the color, the spirit of green when he beheld green, and so on. I beg you to try and picture in a concrete way that the spirit actually approached man thus, vitally. If the external impressions man received had continued to be as active as they were at one time, he would have responded to each one of these impressions with his breathing. For his breathing always responds to any impressions we may receive through our brain or our senses. The impression red comes to us from without. From within comes the breath, which meets it and responds to it with tone. Tone goes forth from man with each impression he receives. There was no such thing as a fixed language. in that far-off time of which we are speaking. But each object, each impression, was instantly responded to by a gesture from within man, by a tone gesture. By means of speech, man entered completely into any being that approached him from without. Speech in its later development is but the degenerate, earthly result, the fallen remnant of that original life-filled language, which was spoken all the world over, and which is recalled in the well-known expression, quote, the lost word, close quote, which is not in the least understood at the present time. The opening words of the Gospel of John, quote, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, close quote, refer to this primal spirit, when man had eyes wherewith to behold not only external objects, but also the Spirit, and when, through his breath, he responded in tone gestures to the things his eyes beheld. It is to this, quote, living at one with the Spirit, close quote, to which the writer of the Gospel refers. On the one hand, we have this living with the Spirit, and on the other we have the fact of man's breathing process, insofar as it extends to the brain. This is not merely an interchange of the air within him with that which is outside, but through his in-breathing and out-breathing, a pulsation takes place through his whole being. Our breathing responds to impressions that come to us from without, when these extend to the brain, but our lower organism also responds to our breathing processes, for instance, in the digestive organs. If man still had the original vitality possessed by his ether body, there would be many more things connected with his breathing process than is the case today. Today it seems as if man's breathing was entirely independent of his digestive processes, though this is not entirely the case. Only the dependence lies, as I might say, behind the veil of existence. It lies hidden within the sphere of things occult. It would have lain in quite another sphere, however, if man had continued with his original life-endowed ether body. If the vitality of his body had not been to a certain extent extinguished, which extinction did not come from the physical body, but from within, and was the cause of death. If man had retained his original predispositions, his digestive processes would have been such that through them something concrete would have come to pass. The result of these processes would not only have been a disintegration of substance, but a construction of substance. This substantiality, evolved by man, would have been laid hold of by the constructive forces of his exhalations, and he would then have produced in his surroundings the animal kingdom as it was originally intended it should be. For the animal kingdom should have been an effluence from man. In this case, he would have had diffused around the tangible results of his mastery over his own nature. It is thus that the animal kingdom should be thought of. These facts, which I am now able to lay before you, are the outcome of much investigation. Natural science still contains some traces of this, in that it speaks of animals being originally much more closely related to man. But the truth, as regards the animal creation, is not as stated by materialistic Darwinism. It is not the case that man has ascended in the scale of existence, but that animals have descended. We are no longer able to conceive of the full relationship of man to the animal kingdom in its original spirit. Just as the plant does not attain its goal within earthly evolution, so the animal kingdom does not here reveal its origin. Animals exist side by side with man, and naturalists ponder on how they have evolved. The reason for their existence side by side with man must be sought in those realms from which man has descended. It cannot possibly be found where Darwin and his materialistic commentators have sought it. It must be sought among the mighty events of prehistoric ages. Only there will it be found. In connection with this fact, recall what I mentioned recently. that, to those who are able to investigate clairvoyantly, it is evident that in the 6th and 7th millennium, men will begin to be unfruitful in the present sense. Women will have become unfruitful, and the species will no longer be reproduced as at present. Reproduction must pass through a metamorphosis. It must find access once more to the spiritual world. In order that the world should not fall into decadence, and opinions as to what is good or evil, in order that the world should not fall into decadence, and opinions as to what is good or evil be treated medically, in order that good and evil should not be considered merely as the business of the state or as a mere human ordinance, the Christ impulse had to enter. In order that in a far future day, when the present laws of nature concerning the human species will of necessity have failed to carry on the race, in order that the world should not fall utterly into ruin, the Christ impulse had to enter the world. It was for this that the Christ impulse entered into the whole of earthly evolution. And are there any who think that this impulse in any way loses in grandeur or sublimity for being placed thus within the whole world order? When, in other words, cosmic rank is restored to it, and men truly acknowledge that at the beginning of earthly evolution other laws than those of nature ruled, as they will also rule at the end. When men are able to feel in this way, they can look back to a time when as yet nothing of a physical nature had entered the moral order, and forward to a time when at its close earthly evolution will be worthy of its beginning. For this the Christ impulse is necessary, for this it entered our earthly evolution, and it is in this sense that we must try to understand it. Those who are able to accept the words of the gospel, not only in an outward sense, but with that true belief demanded by Christ, can find in them all those attributes by which an understanding of the Christ impulse can gradually be gained. The words of the gospels will then acquire a wider meaning, and the impulse of Christ will then be associated with the whole cosmic world order. There are some portions of the Bible that are only rightly understood with the help of spiritual science. We find it written there, quote, "No jot or tittle of the law shall be changed," close quote. Many exponents of the Bible explain these words as if Christ desired that everything in Judaism should remain as it was, only having something added to it through him. This is not what the sentence means. No verse in the Gospels can be torn from its context. A very close connection is always found with what goes before and with what follows. And when this connection is studied, we find the following. On the occasion when Jesus Christ spoke of the jot and tittle, he desired to say, in olden times, when the laws were first framed, man still possessed his ancient inheritance of wisdom, and had not deteriorated to the great extent he has at the present day, when the kingdom of God is drawing nigh, and when a change in his mental attitude is so necessary. You, who are now living in the kingdom of this world, are no longer capable of making any change in the law. Therefore, if the law is to remain true, no change must be made in it. In the olden times there still were prophets, outstanding personalities, who by the Spirit within them were able to discover the law. Now, if it is to remain true, no jot or tittle of it must be changed. The time in which this could be done, according to the ancient methods, is past. Now it must stand. On the other hand, by aid of the qualities newly being born in them, men must endeavor to recognize the law in its ancient meaning. You are scribes, but you are no longer able to understand the Scriptures. You must first attain to the spirit in which the Scriptures were written. You are without in the kingdom of the world. No new law can come into existence there. But to those who are within, will be given the impulse of that living force of which I have said that it will be given by the Christ. This will indeed be given by the Christ, but not in writing. It is not written in the law. It is something different from the law, something intensely living. Those who receive it must begin by estimating the world quite otherwise than merely as a world of the senses. It is in this sense that the words of Jesus Christ respecting the jot and tittle must be taken. In them the first great impulse was given to men to look on the world otherwise than as a world of the senses. Such an outlook could only dawn slowly and gradually on humanity. It often happens that someone speaking in accordance with the meaning of Christ's words is laughed at. Schelling and Hegel have frequently been led into saying what was truly Christian, and it was precisely on these occasions they have been most sharply blamed and were told, quote, "Things in nature are not as you describe them," close quote. And these men were once so misled as to reply, quote, "So much the worse for nature," close quote. That which they said was certainly not in accordance with the natural science of the day, but it was spoken in a Christian sense, in the sense in which Jesus Christ spoke when he said, "Though the scribes say much about the law, this is not the law. Not only a jot and tittle, but very much of the law has been changed by them, for they speak according to the world, and not according to the kingdom of God." He who speaks from the kingdom of God or refers to a world order of which the natural orders is but a subordinate part, and of which it might be said, "So much the worse for nature." Goethe might have replied in much the same way to those who objected to his theory of the propagation of plants, quote, "So much the worse for the plant kingdom that it has entered so deeply into the order of nature," close quote. Minds such as his felt that human perception had to be enlarged, that something had to come alive in human understanding, which would enable men to think, feel, and experience things in such a way that reality would be the result, till in the sixth or seventh millennium a man's words would have as much power in the external world as is found in the seeds of the plant kingdom today. The word must acquire power once more. The word, which today is abstract, must acquire creative force. It must be once more as it was, quote, "in the beginning," close quote. Those who, from the standpoint of occult science, do not venture to add something to the opening lines of the Gospel of John do not speak in accordance with the mind of Christ. To the words, quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," close quote, must be added, quote, "And the Word will be once again," close quote. Jesus Christ put what he had to say in a form that was in sharp opposition to the outer world. But the impulse by which the outer world could be overcome came inevitably from him. It must be allowed that the steep decline in human evolution has meanwhile gone further, that more and more power will be required from the Christ impulse before the earth can receive the necessary upward tendency. We have, on the whole, moved slightly in an upward direction since the mystery of Golgotha, but this has occurred mostly in the thinking consciousness. Man must learn to take part once more in the world processes. He must learn to realize not merely, quote, "When I think, something takes place in my brain," close quote, but, quote, "When I think, something takes place in the cosmos," close quote. That which will have to enter our outer life in order that the Christ impulse may indeed dwell within our ordinary social life is not spoken of by those who may already have some knowledge of it. There are reasons which make such reticence necessary. This can only be mentioned under special circumstances, and only slight indications of it can be given. Take, for instance, that far distant time toward which I allowed you to look as through a window, when men who recognize other laws than those of the state will be treated medically. There will be much opposition at that time. The methods just mentioned will certainly be employed by a part of humanity, but there will be others who by that time will have absorbed the Christ impulse, and there will be strife between the two. But the Christ impulse will remain a living fact. And when, in the present century, the etheric Christ appears, the impulse that streams from him will be a living impulse and will have power to beget such a response in the souls of men as will gradually make impossible a government where the laws are founded on vanity and covetousness, or on prejudice and error. A code of laws will then be discovered, not based on these qualities, but established on a true, a concrete acceptance of the Christ impulse. This will not be determined by parliaments, but will enter the world in a very different way. A slight tendency toward this entrance of the Christ into worldly evolution can be discerned now, and might be described as a longing for the entrance of Christ into the social evolution of humanity. Much thought will be demanded in many directions, and also a great increase in strength, before people are able to accept with earnestness the things I have said about the Christ. When Jesus Christ told the people what it was necessary they should be told, they were filled with wrath, and sought to cast him from the mountaintop. The course of the world's evolution cannot be thought of as simple, and those who have some truth to impart may very easily encounter an attitude of mind such as Jesus Christ encountered in those who sought to cast him from the mountain. In an age when people think, for the most part, that it is well to temporize, not to go to extremes or be notorious in any way, this attitude of mind, which can be described as a longing for the entrance of Christ into the social evolution of humanity, is being prepared for. It is being prepared for in the strata of subconsciousness. Little of it is seen on the surface. On the surface, the un-Christ-like principle of opportunism rules, of which the Christ-like can never be accused, and of whom it could never have been said, quote, "The kingdom of heaven is in no case for you, ye scribes and Pharisees," close quote. Before we can understand to what the Christ here refers, we must first understand what is really contained in the words he addressed to the scribes and Pharisees, for which many excuses have been made. A modern preacher might say many things about Jesus Christ, but he would hardly go so far as to say that he was a practical man. For he advised people to live like the birds of the field, of the air, quote, "who sow not, neither do they reap or gather into barns," close quote. Such advice does not take people far at the present day. It worries people very much, for example, when they hear such instructions as, quote, "whosoever shall smite thee on one cheek, turn to him the other. If any man take away thy coat, give him thy cloak also," close quote. And again, quote, "give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again," close quote. When we read of the meekness of the attitude recommended in this not very favorite passage, we are inclined to feel that in spite of the wonderful words of Jesus Christ, he is here asking rather much of the modern man, who has had to swallow a great deal in order to retain the Gospels. In matters such as this, we have need, in the first place, of a true understanding. Everything depends on this. Now, it is very difficult to gain an understanding of all these matters which are so closely connected one with another. Some idea of their inner connection may be arrived at when, after reading the words quoted above, we find immediately following them in the Gospel of Luke, quote, "do unto others as you would that they should do unto you," close quote. This naturally refers to what has gone before. Christ demands that the power of faith and belief be applied to this idea. If Jesus Christ had sought only to unfold such ideas as existed already in the world, superficial ideas, he would certainly not have said, quote, "if any man take thy coat from thee, give him thy cloak also," close quote. He does not speak here of laws that obtain in outward things. Such are for the scribes and high priests. But he speaks here of the kingdom of heaven, and he demonstrates clearly in these words that there other laws hold sway than in the outer world. If you compare the words of the Gospel of Luke with those found in the Gospel of Matthew, you will see that Jesus Christ wished to say something that would stimulate an attitude of faith, that would at once render ineffective anything connected with the law, as expressed in the sentence about the coat and mantle. In these words, Christ wished to show that it was not enough that people should simply be taught, quote, "Thou shalt not steal," close quote, for through this nothing is accomplished. We know that he said, quote, "No jot shall be removed from the law," close quote, but these words, in their original acceptance, no longer contain any impulse at the present day. People must be able to evolve within themselves the power that makes it possible, so long as the social order remains as it is, that if their coat be taken from them, they will give up their mantle also. When all men live under the influence of the thought, quote, do not do to others what you would not they should do to you, close quote, no one will be able to steal another's mantle. Mantles will, however, only cease to be stolen when those from whom they have been stolen have within them the power, given by the attitude of mind that says, so soon as he takes my coat, I will give him my cloak also. The social order where such an attitude of mind holds sway must come. When it does, there will be no more stealing. It is this thought which Jesus Christ wished to express. This is the kingdom of God, as opposed to the kingdom of men. Men must develop the mighty, quote, power of faith, close quote. Morality must be founded upon this inner power, which means that it has miraculous qualities. Each moral act must become a miracle, and not be merely an act of nature. Men must become capable of performing miracles. The original world order, having been dragged from the heights down to a lower region, the purely natural order must be confronted once more with a supernatural moral order, capable of doing something more than merely to follow the path of nature. It is not enough merely to follow the ancient laws, which had been given under quite different conditions. Nor is it enough that these laws should be changed, but man will have to enter in a living way into a new order that is not that of nature, an order wherein, if a man steal another's coat, the attitude of that man will be such that he will give him his cloak also, and not hate him at once to justice, and not hail him at once to justice. The words in the Gospel of Matthew seem to convey that Jesus Christ wished to do away with the law. Had this been the case, there would have been no sense in adding to the sentence about the coat and cloak the injunction, quote, "Do to others as ye would that they should do unto you," close quote. The whole matter bears the stamp of another kingdom, a kingdom where miracles take place. Jesus Christ performed signs and wonders through his mighty super-earthly power of faith. No one who sees man merely as a being of nature and does not see in him something more can do the things that Christ did. The attitude of mind desired by Christ, in the moral realm at least, was an attitude of mind which dwelt more in ideas than in external reality. In external life, men hold, quote, "If a man take thy coat, take it from him again," close quote. On such social maxims, no social order in the meaning of the Christ impulse could possibly be established. In Christ's kingdom, ideas would have to contain something more than that which merely corresponds with the outer world. If this were not so, an extraordinary contrast would be seen between these different sentences. Quote, "If a man strike thee on one cheek, turn to him the other. If a man steal thy coat, give him thy cloak also. If a man desire anything of thee, give it to him. And if he take what is thine, ask it not again. Do unto others as ye would they should do unto thee." Close quote. contrast with these the words, quote, "When you strike a man on one cheek, see that he promptly offers you the other, so that you may experience the satisfaction a second time. If you steal a man's coat, do not stop there, but take his cloak also. If you want anything, take good care, you get it," etc. Close quote. This would be the opposite of what is expressed in the thought, quote, "Do to others as you would they should do unto you." Close quote. When spoken in an earthly sense, the whole thing is meaningless, a mere sequence of phrases. The first gain meaning when the following is added to them, quote, "Those who would partake of the salvation, which will be accomplished by Jesus Christ, by which the world will be raised once more to higher realms, must start from maxims not entirely in accordance with the world." Close quote. Something will then be accomplished that will endow moral ideas and conceptions once more with physical force. An immense courage of soul is necessary before the Gospels can be understood in the sense of the mystery of Golgotha, a courage sorely needed by man at the present day. To this belongs, in the first place, the serious acceptance of those things which are placed by Jesus Christ in direct opposition to the kingdom that had gradually arisen under the downward-tending stream of evolution. Men must have courage to unite the kingdom of the world with the kingdom of heaven. The Gospels speak everywhere of courage. From every part of them we hear the call, "Courage!" summoning us to follow that impulse which Jesus Christ has implanted in the earth. In these lectures I have tried to bring the mystery of Golgotha somewhat nearer to you by showing that it must be thought of as being implanted within the whole cosmic order, and that it can only be understood when we acknowledge that a higher form of speech is heard in the Gospels than the ordinary speech of man. Theological development in the 19th century has tried to drag the Gospels down to the level of human speech. The first task of the new century will be to learn how to read them once more from the standpoint of the Word of God, and in this connection, spiritual science will prove an aid to their understanding. The end of Lecture 4.